Thank you for joining us for the Dev Team. We're your hosts, Mark Onsman,
Jake Overall,
and Ryan Coates.
We're a group of developers and instructors here to discuss the world of software development. So whether you're brand new or an experienced developer, we're here to chat on topics that affect our lives each and every day.
This week on the Dev Team, we talk about our dates. In the news, Jake updates us with Windows 11. And finally, we deep dive into our own personal book club recommendations. All right. Well, starting with that awkward topic, dates.
Relationships are hard.
Yeah,
that's
really.
That's what I mean, right?
I haven't actually been on a date in a long time, unless you count your wife as already going on a date.
I think you should definitely count your wife as a date.
Okay.
I don't think that's the type of thing we're talking about today.
Oh, that's right. We're talking about dates in code and how much of a nightmare they can sometimes be. And we have some differences of opinion here, but if you've ever had to work in an application with dates, kind of the generic use of dates is not actually too bad. But it comes into problems when you actually have to start managing time zones and managing, you know, oh, this data was created in this time zone. So do I save its time according to when that person made it or when the server date is? And how do I manage like that type of stuff, handling the offsets, handling, okay, here's content that gets released at a certain time on a certain day. Does that apply to time zones? How do I figure that out? How do I, you know, what are some experiences with dates?
Dates are hard. And then taking like the modern JavaScript frameworks, things of that nature, and then having to reformat your date back into a usable. It's almost like you have to format your date for something that the user to see, and then you have to format your date into a very specific format in order for it to, you know, like do data binding and things of that nature for your different input fields, your form fields, things of that nature. So dates are, they're atrocious. It's a nightmare, right? And I say that from the perspective more of as a teacher who's teaching brand new developers, you know, the world of software development, right? Dates are one of the things that I push off because people struggle with them so much because there's a lot of oddities to it.
I just use Unix time for everything.
Just we'll ignore internationalization and
yeah, we'll just start ticking a counter up. I mean, it's just gonna keep going and going and going.
Well, I mean, let's talk about the concept of, you know, where that, where, you know, date time, right? Because that's kind of where the issue comes from. And if we talk about dates, it's, you know, there's no such date as December 30th 1969 doesn't exist according to computers, right?
That's true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that's a really arbitrary thing, right? Like most of our timestamps are based off of the, you know, milliseconds elapsed since January 1 of 1970, right? And I don't know if you guys remember, but a couple of years back there was the whole like, hey, you can unlock retro mode on your iPhone if you go and you set your system date to something before that 1970, right? I don't know. Did you guys hear about this or not?
I haven't heard about this. No.
Oh my God. It was this thing that was sweeping the internet at the time. And, actually, so when people would go and they would change their system time to something before 1970, Apple had kind of a little bug in their thing and it would actually brick your iPhone.
Oh gosh.
Also, so really retro, as in.
Yeah, it is super retro. It stopped
as
working.
And you no longer have a smartphone retro.
And it was, it did a serious amount of damage where people actually had to like reset back to factory defaults, but the device wouldn't even really power on. So it was like a hard key reset type of thing. So and to Apple's credit, you know, they patched that problem pretty quick. I think it was within like 1 to 2 days after it went wild on the internet, but tons of people ended up bricking their phones over it because of something stupid like a date.
Well, and for those of you old enough, I think we had that whole Y2K thing. You remember that?
You know, I remember telling my buddies, I was like, oh, you guys are crazy. This isn't going to ruin your computers. But I remember, 1999, right before midnight, I definitely turned my computer off. And I was like, well, let's see. I want to make sure that I don't lose my Age of Empires.
I actually perfectly timed it that I turned off all the lights in the room that people were in when it hit. And people, oh, my God.
Y2K.
Well, and it's interesting because the whole Unix epoch thing, kind of they talk about another Y2K sort of potential in, what is it, 2038?
Yeah, I think that's when we'll exceed the it's the max integer for most computers.
Right.
For the millisecond time, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, and they've actually, they're working towards a solution for that. They have to actually code a new type into JavaScript to support a number that big, big int.
Big int. Oh, yeah, yeah. And again, I mean, we talk about numbers in different programming languages, and regardless of kind of the language, it's more the underlying technology of the computer, right? And it's the precision, right? We talk about precision and with floating points and, you know, for how accurate do you need your number to be? Right? And out to so many decimal points, you start losing precision. And when we start talking about time, you know, seconds, milliseconds, and, you know, numbers, of course, are weird because they divide infinitely. So it can be this really weird thing just to keep computers all on time. And then we also have to account for things like leap years and the fact that the world atomic clock gets set back every now and again or set forward by, you know, tiny milliseconds at a time. And all of that has to kind of come into play and adjust. So dates are weird. They suck.
Yeah, I think you know, there's a lot of particular challenges in how we, what we do with dates and date times, right? And I think a lot of the challenge is how we choose to, you know, to Mark's point earlier, how do we choose to store them? Like why would we choose one way or the other? I mean, we could just store them in, I mean, we could just store the Unix epoch, right, if we wanted to. It's this number. That's the time. It's the same everywhere, right? But, you know, obviously that's not particularly user friendly. Obviously, I think you guys do a fair bit more front end work than I do. So you guys have unique challenges when you're doing things with front end concerns, because you have users from all over the place with different computers, different computer settings, you know, all that kind of stuff. You got people on phones who are traveling between time zones. I know what that's like. So, I mean, do you guys have any kind of hard and fast rules that you follow? Any kind of, you know, things you encourage? Like what are you? How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of ISO string format, right? So I'll usually lead people down more that route. That's how we actually save it out in the database. If you take something like a document database, MongoDB, CosmosDB, things of that nature, they'll take that ISO format and convert it back in, so you can do like date queries where it's must be before or within, you know, X time frame and things of that nature. So ISO is a pretty good format, but then once again, when you send that string back to your client, you got some client work to do just to, you know, format it to some input boxes, format it for the screen. And, you know, there's some good libraries out there. I can't remember what Moment.js was a big one that a lot of Luxon. People use. Yeah, I think it's now called Luxon. So they changed the name there. But that's one of those, you know, hey, this was posted 3 minutes ago as opposed to random date, you know, being dropped to the screen. So
yeah, and the thing that's like tough but fun and interesting, fun is maybe the wrong word too, but with that is, yeah, 3 minutes ago, well, if this was posted 3 minutes ago in, you know, the East Coast and now it's Mountain Time, you have to account for that offset. And that's the biggest thing you have to take in my opinion, that I'm always having to adjust for, as I'm having to look up, all right, what's the modification from this to that? And then you get the weird time zones. I think it's China that has 30 minute time zone differences in some cases. Those are super fun.
Yeah, I think a few European African countries have similar 30-minute jumps as well.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you have some companies where they just say, hey, the time where this will go live is, you know, 5 p.m. Pacific time, right? It take a California-based company. This goes live 5 p.m. Pacific time, you know, for all users worldwide, right? But we've seen companies make mistakes where it's like, hey, we're in Australia and we got it a whole day early, right? Nintendo has made that mistake on like their main website and, you know, release information being, you know, partial to where you're at based upon location. And of course, we've seen where you can trick devices by just changing your system clock. And if you trust the client side clock,
always validate, right? On the server,
yeah,
side.
Always validate on the server side, right? Don't just trust the user clock, right? Because we've seen people that will hack websites, hack systems, you know, get early information by just changing their own local clock time. And that's something that's real simple to do. And many large corporations have fallen prey to, you know, those types of attacks.
I think the other thing to be kind of aware and mindful of is, yeah, consider this coming weekend, daylight savings time, November 7th.
Oh, we still like, believe in that?
Yeah. And some states do and some states don't. So now you have to account for certain times of the year, it's this time. And other times of the year, it's this time. So that's another one that's just such a bonkers, like we made these decisions at some point and like how much they've impacted just simple all the way down the road. Like when they made those decisions, no one thought, well, these developers are going to have a hard time with
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we use a lot of ISO 8601 standardization, and for the most part, we store everything in GMT, right? We don't offset for time zones. If we're going to capture that for like a front end reason or a client side library or something, that would generally be something that's collected as well. So it gets stored in the database as well as the kind of offset that might have been calculated at the time. But that way, at least we've got a standard number. And here's the thing. Yes, if it was posted 3 minutes ago in Eastern time, it was still posted 3 minutes ago here. It's just a different time right, when I do the offset calculation. But no, I think, you know, to your point, I think a lot of our client devices and stuff take care of a lot of the harder parts for us. You know, things like, you know, I don't remember the last time I had to change a clock in my house other than my oven. Right. You know, everything else is pretty much a computer these days, and it just automatically updates itself on the right day. Right? I don't have to think about it. I just know I got woke up way earlier than I should have, that kind of thing. Right. And I think a lot of us are used to that now. Like I remember growing up as a kid, all kinds of stuff I got to reprogram twice a year. Right. But yeah, no, I think that's obviously the luxury of doing a lot of backend stuff. Like I don't have to worry too much about the client side stuff, or I own the client side library that I do have to care about. You know, coupled at that point. So I'm not too fussed about it.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, find a solution that works for you, write it once and reuse it everywhere. Maybe, yeah. Maybe turn it into an NPM package.
Ooh, NPM.
Spicy. Don't do that.
Yeah.
By the time they went down last week, right?
Wouldn't be able to download it anyway, right?
By the time people are hearing this, that was a couple of weeks ago, but yeah, whew, that was fun. And that had nothing to do with date. So, but it is a news topic. So, Jake, I'll just kind of kick it over to you.
Yeah. So, talking about dates and early releases and things of that nature. I don't know if you guys have looked at Windows 11 yet.
Oh, I looked at you using Windows 11 and decided, nope.
So Windows 11, has officially been released. You can install it. As long as your computer is eligible for it, right? One of the big things is you have to have a TPM, which is a trusted platform module. And that's I think it's a 2.0 or something of that nature, for the particular version of that chip. And so that is one of the hardware requirements of Windows 11. But what is interesting about, Windows 11 is, it's really just a pretty UI wrapper for Windows 10 and then a whole chunk of security apps thrown on top of that. So the main core itself of what Windows 10 is still actually sitting there. I won't go as far to say it's the same kernel or anything of that nature, but the core system, you know, the upgrade process for me was actually really simple. I just basically went and did am I eligible? Yes, you're eligible. And clicked to run this upgrade. And it was like any other Windows update. It took a little bit to install. And then when it popped back up, it was, hey, here's a couple of settings to reconfigure and you're good to go. One of the things I did have to do, though, for those people that are, you know, into virtualization and things of that nature is currently at this current point in time, the virtualization is not supported on Windows 11. So I had to disable it and I had to uninstall VirtualBox. But I did get a nice little warning where Windows, you know, said, hey, this is incompatible at this current moment in time. So we've blocked you from updating unless you go uninstall this thing. So like any random user, I'm like, oh, of course, I don't need it. I'll go uninstall it. Right. And so I uninstalled it and then, you know, hit check again and it was good to go. So really not a bad process. There are some nice things I have liked about kind of the update. There's also been a couple of things like Windows 11 uses a lot of rounded edges now. And clicking the close button, you'll sometimes see the little like square X pop back up on that rounded corner, which is just disappointing.
I think the other thing I remember you having to fix is we couldn't run Node out of the box.
Oh, yeah. I had to stop and restart the port service in order for...
The permissions were like
permissions
reset.
Permissions were all messed up or something. I can't remember exactly what that was. So
I remember, we tried to run our own little like static server host and it just basically denied access to the ports. And so we had to,
restart NetStat essentially, I think is what it was.
Yep. Yep. And I suppose that's probably more of an issue with an in-place upgrade rather than a fresh build or something.
Right? Yeah. I believe that that's exactly what it was. So just, you know, stopping and restarting the service seemed to resolve the issue just fine.
So what are the types of, what are some of the things you enjoy about it specifically?
So I think one of the things that's nice, and you know, I thank Windows for this. If you've seen the images, they've centered the taskbar on the bottom. all your different icons.
I hate it.
You can adjust that back to the left where it should be. So that is the single most important thing I've seen with the upgrade to Windows 11 is I can still, you know, throw my taskbar.
I didn't mind the centering. I didn't understand why the start button was still at the left. Like, shouldn't it be right in the middle? Like, that's what I was like, why is it off to the left still? You know, it definitely has some vibes of a certain other operating system, you know, centered the buttons long time ago.
Yeah, a long time ago.
As somebody uses multi-platforms, I'm actually looking forward to the change. Everything will look much more similar to me. No, I haven't actually got to play with it a lot. You know, it's one of the first versions of Windows, you know, that I'm not sure I'll be able to put on my main workstation. My main workstations have always been what we call white box. I built them myself, right? So they don't have TPM chips in them because most motherboards you buy to build your own computers out of don't have TPM chips. Now I can go get a TPM module and plug it in and do all that. It's really TPM module is just somewhere for me to store a set of keys, right? Security items. And obviously Windows 11 is wrapped around this kind of secure boot concept. Again, they're trying to, you know, I think they're trying to minimize, you know, things like ransomware and, you know, how much access to the system that those type of applications and things can get hold of. And they're also moving towards this kind of passwordless future. That's one of Microsoft's big goals is this kind of passwordless future where you don't have to have, keys and codes that you remember because, you know, most people start writing them down when they get too many of them. We won't go into the benefits of password managers here, but I do think that's kind of the future that Microsoft sees. And they've talked about it before when Windows Hello was earlier on in its development. They started teaming up with YubiKey and stuff like that. They started talking about this is what we want the future to be. No passwords. Like, you don't need a password to get onto your, you know, we'll figure out who you are. Well, that's an interesting concept.
Yeah. You know, and there's a lot that we could rabbit hole into on that conversation.
My sysadmin head is like going, I don't really understand how this is a thing, but I'll read more about it.
Yeah. And, you know, I stepping away from passwords, I think, is a step in the right direction for sure, because obviously some of the biggest vulnerabilities exist around weak passwords, people not remembering them or only changing them by like a single number on the end, right? Like, poor password management has led to the majority of breaches that have occurred. Maybe that's not fair to say the majority, but definitely a lot of them have been due to poor user password management. So I definitely think it's a step in the right direction. I do like the concept behind the TPM chip and what Microsoft is trying to do with Windows 11. What's difficult, though, and this is something I think that exists just in the realm of cybersecurity, is getting the average user to understand, you know, the why behind, you know, something like a TPM chip. It's a pretty technical thing. And so it is sometimes overly complicated, whereas an end user might just be saying, oh, what the heck? Like, I just bought this computer from Best Buy, you know, 10 minutes ago, and you're telling me I can't upgrade because it's not good enough. Right. And that instantly breeds anger.
Oh, but at the same time, I think your average user, especially, every time you get a change like this with cosmetic updates and stuff like that, people go bonkers. Oh no, this is terrible. Take it back. Make it look the way it is. I don't know where the buttons are anymore. You get a lot of that kind of, you know, every time Facebook do an A/B test, the amount of people that just, oh no. And it's fair. There's obviously lots of users that navigate through, through experience, through memory. Like, I know that button takes me to where I want. And if you move that button, you change that button. Oops. Right. You've now alienated a lot of users, and Windows 11 is definitely doing that. I think a lot of sysadmins, a lot of enterprise IT folks, they're probably, we won't go into some of the weird choices they made, like bundling Xbox apps and stuff on there, but a lot of enterprise IT folks are probably looking at this from a security perspective going, this is quite exciting. This is quite an interesting move. And, you know, your average consumer will just complain that, oh, you've moved my buttons around, right? I mean, we'll see what that looks like over time. I remember when, obviously 10 came out, it's going to be the last Windows. We're never have another Windows. Just going to be evergreen, right? We're going to just keep updating. And I think they did a really great job of that from Windows 10's perspective, like watching it. And, you know, I used to rebuild my machines at least once a year from scratch, like wipe the hard drive, start again. I haven't had to do that. Like, every time you get one of those big updates, it's pretty much refreshing most of the Windows elements that used to kind of make your machine feel a little stale. And like you said, the upgrade process to 11 is very similar to that. It's just, you know, off you go. I'm keen to see what it's like. I've got a few laptops that'll run on fine. I'm just a little, you know, I won't be able to put it on my main workstation, which is, honest, it's a first for me. I mean, I've been using Windows since 3.1.1 for work groups, I think. Right. And, first one, I won't be able to just upgrade. I'd have already dumped it on that machine already. I'm always one of them early adopters, but I haven't really been able to mess around with it.
I think it's interesting that you bring up the UI freshness. And I think it was last episode or maybe the one before. I believe you're still using old Reddit, Ryan?
Absolutely. that's not, we can, new Reddit looks okay, but the functionality is terrible. Like if you're going to remove functionality, that's a problem, right? People, you know, and I think we've talked about this too, from a UX perspective, you know, making things nicer, flashier, new, you know, everybody likes a bit of a refresh, right? Ooh, new lick of paint looks good. But if you do that and at the same time remove a ton of functionality, people are going to get grumpy about it.
I think, Jake, we were trying to hook up to the projector and it was like three menus deep now.
Oh, yeah.
Connect to a wireless device.
Connecting to a wireless device is no longer on the Windows P, but they have added it to Windows K. So that's okay. But, you know, it would have been nice to see the little shortcut there. Hey, looking for this, here's your new hotkey for it. That was annoying. Yeah, I would agree with that. I forgot about that one. But it is funny, you know, you're talking about updating, refreshing UIs. One of the things, my number one pet peeve, and I remember when GitHub did this and I was absolutely furious, but something that used to be one click away, now being two clicks away, right? When it was, hey, I want to go clone this repo, it's now a drop down and then a click for the clone as opposed to just being a single clone. And I remember just being absolutely furious about that. And now that I don't even think about it, but when it first released, I was upset.
I think that you see that more in kind of thinking about those two different things, right? There's a difference between a UI change, which to me is kind of that fresh coat of paint you're talking about, and a UX change, which my process in which I need to complete something has completely changed. And I think that that's where I would encourage. And again, I'm not saying I'm smarter than Microsoft or Reddit or whatever, but I think it is something to take into consideration when you are updating your app, whether it's just a simple, you know, browser app, or if it's something just much more complex, like an internal tooling system, consider the changes of UX. If someone is familiar with, hey, I take these are steps I do all the time, and how much of an impact you're going to have potentially on their workflow, especially if it's, say, like an internal tool. You know, will this, what I think is a minor change, how much impact will that potentially even have on my business, on the business as a whole, if now all my users have to take these extra three steps that aren't really necessary?
Yeah, but just think of how much more income you've generated for all those Puppeteer and Selenium developers.
Fair enough.
Yeah, absolutely. Rewriting a bunch of front-end tests to even now work with your new update. You push that off to the testers and say, oh, I got a new UI.
I mean, we call this job security in our industry, right?
Right.
That's why I push bad code.
So, I mean, that's kind of it for what I have for the news. So I think that'll take us over into our deep dive topic.
Sure. So deep dive today, we're going to talk a little different. We're going to kind of have a little book club. We'll talk about some books that are always on our shelf, books we turn to, books that we recommend to others. You know, and maybe I'll throw in some ops, DevOps ones in there for the mix, but you know, I guess we'll focus on development stuff. So who wants to start?
I think that's a fun topic for sure. Right. Like I have my go-to books, you know, ones I read over and over again, you know, for fun. I know it's weird. I read workbooks.
You read
for
development
fun.
Books for fun.
Sometimes I do. Depends on the book, right? And then I think, you know, we can expand this to, it doesn't necessarily have to be a tech book, but you know, maybe even like a self-help book, you know, something that you've pulled maybe wise advice from, things of that nature. But to kind of kick us off from a get-go, from like, I need to learn how to code. I don't know how to code. My very first book, you know, I'll call it my baby software development book, was the Head First books. I absolutely love them. And in particular, Head First with C#. That was a book that I wore it completely out. And I've since, you know, refreshed it, and we keep it in stock here for our students. But Head First with C#, absolutely, like one of my favorite books. I loved going through the examples. It presented the concepts to me in a way that I felt like I was actually successful in becoming a software developer. So that book, I think, will always have, like, you know, special place in my heart type of thing, because it was one of the ones I first used when starting to learn to code. So definitely highly, highly recommend if you want to learn a specific language, picking up the Head First books. And I've since, you know, I've read Head First with JavaScript, Head First with HTML. I think it's HTML and CSS, I believe. So those books I definitely highly recommend.
I think top of my list is probably Clean Code. I think it's one of those that I recommend probably the most, because people I recommend books to the most are just entering the field as junior developers. But I think it can be a good refresher for anybody who's been in the industry for a while, because it really breaks down like, okay, cool, you know how to code, great. But do you know how to code right or well? Or how do you write, you know, if you look at like, oh, the top things a developer needs to do, clean, readable, reusable code, all those things are incredibly important. And it really breaks it down, I think, in a fairly simple way, and stuff that just makes sense. It's just small changes. For example, I think one of the ones I like to call out a lot is Boolean variable conventions for naming. Instead of calling something like published, you should call it is published, because this is a small thing and it just makes it so much easier to read, and it adds clarity to even something just as so simple as a variable. And so I think that there's not just that, but there's tons more ways of cleaning up your code, refactoring, going through. Great, it works, but is it readable? Is it usable? You know, sometimes that one line function that's super complicated is maybe not the best approach to a problem. It may be like, oh, I feel really cool because I did this whole thing in one line. But if anybody else has to read that and they're not in my current mindset, they're going to struggle with it. So it calls out stuff like that.
When you go back to read it in a year.
We talked about that a little bit with a couple of weeks ago. Like, I go back into my own code and go, who wrote this?
It was hard to write. It should be hard to read. So,
yeah, exactly. Right?
Where's the git blame? Oh, me, my bad.
So definitely that's one. Clean Code is kind of top of my list.
Yeah, so one of the books, so obviously I became a developer after I was, you know, an operator for years. I always had a certain hard time. It was one of the few things I didn't teach myself, right? I had to go to class for it. A lot of my operation stuff, you know, I started back when I was a kid, did NT4 stuff, you know, networking, that kind of stuff. I always struggled with development. And I don't know if it was just, you know, the feedback you need, like I forgot a semicolon, so the whole thing stopped working, right? That kind of thing, having someone over your shoulder to tell you that or not. One of the books I read was really kind of an introduction, I guess, to computing. It's a book called Code, The Hidden Language of Computer Hardware and Software. And it basically walks you through from like the advent of stuff like Morse code and repeaters and all that kind of stuff to how we got to modern, you know, integrated circuits, right? Like AND gates, OR gates, all that kind of, like, you could sit there and build these out with, you know, physically, but, you know, I think you think about some of the early computers, like I think you could still do that. I think there's kind of a hobby market out of it now, right? But it kind of walks through like what a computer is doing. Like the electricity is going from here to here. And when it gets to this type of thing, this happens. When it gets to this type of thing, this happens. And it kind of walks you through that. And I found that very enlightening, and it made a lot of the kind of theory around computer science and start to make a lot more sense. And that was something I probably read, I don't know, maybe 8-10 years ago or something. I can't quite remember. But I found that to be a really good book. If you're struggling with some of the, you know, computational theory, some of the stuff that underlying like whys and, you know, that kind of stuff, this was a nice read. It was kind of nice follow along. You're sitting there going, oh, I kind of want to build this like out of Morse code repeaters now. You know, I can build a computer this way, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I know exactly which book you're talking about. I've actually read, I won't say I've read that one from cover to cover, but I definitely have read through it. I've, you know, pulled snippets from it. So excellent book. I really like, for today's like entry, if that's something that you do find intriguing, interesting, is go through like go buy a $35 Raspberry Pi and go through the getting started with Pi tutorials, because it goes through a lot of those things too. It's like, you know, first let's blink a light, right? Like the hello world of small electronics, right? Let's get a blinking light going. And then from there, yeah, it's, you know, do everything from turning on, you know, a water fountain to, you know, turning it off and, you know, seeing a bunch of different things. So yeah, I absolutely love that style of learning as well. It's very hands-on, you know, when it needs to be. And that's what I like about like the Raspberry Pi, and the entry point is, you know, very cheap.
I think to throw in a book that maybe isn't coding related, if I'm allowed to drift a little bit, one of the ones I like from kind of a management leadership standpoint is First Break All the Rules. That's a pretty good one that I've enjoyed, because it's a little bit niche, and it worked really well for me at the time, because it's kind of about going in and you're starting into a position, leading a team that maybe had unsteady leadership before, or you kind of want to set expectations appropriately with the team. And it really talks about how to get in and kind of establish some ground rules, as it were, or kind of establish, you know, hey, how do I get a good temperature on, you know, how my team's doing? It gives you kind of 12 questions to ask a team member and to better evaluate their situation at work. And it starts with, it's kind of a Maslow's kind of hierarchy thing. You start with some of the early stuff, you know, do you have a comfortable, are you comfortable in your station or whatever your workspace is? And later builds into things like, do you have a friend at work and stuff like that? And basically for every yes answer, you get a point and it kind of evaluates, okay, if your team averages in this point range, you know, here's some techniques, or if they're in this point range, you know, here's some other techniques as they get more and more comfortable in their space. Because as we've talked about and hashed out over several different episodes and at different times, a lot of times people work at a company not because of the company itself, right? In my opinion, a lot of times the people work at a company in their product or whatever, it's kind of boring, right? And I don't mean to dig on anybody in particular, but for me, speaking from my own perspective, like a finance application or environment, or even a healthcare application or environment would be kind of boring. It's not super interesting to me. But if you have a good, strong team, a good, strong leadership, and the company itself is really supporting of your own personal growth, it doesn't matter that the product you have is boring. So I really like that book because it, again, it helps identify how you as a leader can make sure you are providing the best work environment for the people who work for you.
You know, and I like that concept around, you know, and this is something I will sometimes tell our students is it's like, you know, we're doing a Pokemon challenge today, right? And, you know, I have people, I hate Pokemon. I don't care.
What's a Pokemon?
I don't care, right? What I care about is, you know, you need to build an application that's data in, data out, right? And so regardless of what the underlying data is, you know, you should hopefully find joy in the aspects of, you know, programming, building the application, things of that nature, you know, first and foremost, right? If the data is also interesting to you, then that's just bonus, right? Yeah, I think it's perfectly fair to go down that line of, you know, books that you find, maybe not specifically coding, but, you know, a good book, one that I absolutely love. I just actually picked it up. I think it was earlier this year or maybe at the end of last year, but it's called Never Split the Difference. And it's all about the art of negotiation. And it's interesting because it's one of those books where...
Is that the one with like the FBI hostage negotiator?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I love this book, right? So the guy, yeah, he was an FBI hostage negotiator. And the premise behind the book of Never Split the Difference is, you know, when negotiating in life and death scenarios, you can't say like, oh, well, go ahead and release half the prisoner or half the hostages and kill the other and we'll all be happy, right? It's you can never split that difference. So he had to walk away or he had to approach every negotiation with the concept of I have to, you know, quote unquote, win. I need to make sure that I'm taking away what I truly want. And he talks about in that book how when you split the difference, both parties usually walk away disappointed. And so when you never split the difference, it's all about getting both parties to work together for what is the best outcome.
And I think that's actually common relationship advice that I've seen before. And whenever you're arguing with somebody, and this is just a good life pro tip, it's kind of off topic, but always think about it as, you know, we're not, don't argue with each other. You're not fighting each other. You're fighting an issue.
Yeah, you're fighting the problem, right? And that's actually, there's a whole chapter dedicated to that in that book. And, you know, again, it's a real quick read. Absolutely love it. It's available on Audible as well. And, you know, the narrator does a good job as well.
It's funny. You know, most of my bookshelf these days is very much these kind of leadership books and stuff like that. So sorry for all you junior devs. What I always recommend Extreme Ownership. It's written by an ex-Navy SEAL. And again, it's really about, you know, when you're in a position of authority, a position of leadership, right? You know, it's the responsibility ultimately falls to me. It doesn't matter how big my team is. It doesn't matter who messed up. Like if I've, you know, you've probably heard of the term things like blameless postmortems, right? And, you know, and you hear these stories about something, you know, the Facebook outage last week. Oh, no, who got fired for that? And it's like, well, did anyone get fired for that? Because, you know, if you're saying that your systems are so weak that somebody could maliciously go and do that on purpose, that, you know, it, ultimately the buck stops with me and my org, right? Like from an engineering perspective. So if I have not set up an environment where everybody else can succeed, where, you know, everybody else can deliver quality and things like that. Like that's on my back, right? That's for me to own and try and resolve. It's not for me to point fingers and go, hey, subordinate X, you suck. It's all your fault. I'm going to tell leadership it was all your fault, right? That's a terribly toxic way to run an org for starters. And I think we've all worked in places like that before or teams like that, whatever. But yeah, no, Extreme Ownership is a great book. You know, obviously it's obviously told through the narration of some of the events in this guy's obviously military career. But I think there's a lot to take there for any type of leadership position.
Here's another out there one. Have you ever read Lie Spotting?
I haven't even heard of that one.
Lie Spotting is not necessarily intended for this purpose, I don't think, but it's basically a book on reading people. And it's, again, takes it from that perspective of, you know, interrogation practices and stuff like that, and then reading micro expressions and things. But that was another book that I read just at the time because I thought, oh, cool, I'm going to be able to tell when I'm a human lie detector, right? But in reality, it teaches you a lot about, like, yeah, just emotional EI. Reading people, reading their body language, reading their emotional, again, micro expressions versus macro expressions, and how to pay attention in certain scenarios, you know, and really, I think it's helped understand people less than it is about like, oh, is this person lying to me? But I can clearly tell by this person's body language and their micro expressions and how they're acting right now that they're feeling afraid or they're feeling guilty. Ryan, you know, that's the face of disgust, Ryan. So
my bad.
But that said, I think that that's another one that's really helped with kind of that EI standpoint, which I think as a developer, we struggle with a lot. One that's on my list that I haven't gotten to yet is soft skills is another one. I don't remember if there's a subtitle there, but there's definitely it's a developer book that's written to kind of, again, as developers, how do we emotionally relate to people?
Yeah. And, you know, to talk about that book in particular, right? I believe it's written by John Somis, who is actually an Idaho native. It's one of those things where sometimes, and this is maybe my personal opinion, which again, we're in book club, so I'll just say it. but when that book was first written, I definitely feel like the guy presented a lot of excellent topics, a lot of really good, you know, just ways to take control of your professional growth, right? He does a very good job of that. Since then, I would definitely say I don't follow him as an author or an individual.
Do not pick up book two.
And again, maybe that's my own personal opinion, but I highly disagree with his next couple of books and some of his like YouTube following and things of that nature. So sometimes, you know, a good golden gem may pop out of, you know, maybe an older book, which Soft Skills is an older book now at this point.
I was going to follow on from the EI conversation. You know, there's a UX kind of, well, it's not really a UX book, but it's called Don't Make Me Think. And it's about the kind of, you know, human computer interface and, you know, how poorly we can do it and how we should not do it that poorly. Right? What's the joke? You know, user experience is like jokes. If you have to explain it, you've done it wrong, right? No, so this book.
Could you explain that joke? I don't get it.
Yeah, no, I know. So this is kind of And again, I don't do a ton of front end stuff. I don't do a ton of things that you might consider UX out of the gate. But even when I'm designing back end APIs, there's still an experience. Now, people will say, well, computer's supposed to use your API. I'm like, okay, still human has to figure it out. Human has to understand it. You know, it needs to be able to grok what those property names mean, you know, going back to your is published versus published, right? There's a lot of things you can glean from that, whether you think you do UX or not. Anytime you make an interaction for somebody or some interface for a system to talk to, then UX is a part of it. And, you know, it's another short book, but it's a great little read to kind of get you a bit more thoughtful about those kind of decisions and what's and why's.
Yeah. And, you know, to kind of go back into that more technical reading, things of that nature. There's a couple of really good books that I've picked up on game design, right? And, you know, just how to do game design. What is it? And
you game design,
regardless of, you know, the engine that you're using, or if you are been using an engine, you know, one of those is, design patterns through game programming. I can't remember exactly who wrote that one. I don't have it right in front of me, but absolutely love that book. It's one of my like go-tos for just learning design patterns. And a lot of times I'll go back and I'll revisit that book when I'm looking at various different design patterns, because I love the examples that it gives through them because it gamifies them, And using games, often, you know, games usually have really stringent rules. So it's easy to say like, oh, well, this is a rule of the game, so I can identify it must follow these particular things. Otherwise, that's cheating or that's invalid or, you know, X, Y, Z. So I find that a really nice way of picking up something complicated or what can be a very complicated topic, such as the design patterns, you know, in a fun gamified way. And then there's another one, I believe it's called Leveling Up Game Design. And the book itself is written as almost if it were a video game. You know, it's even got like little tabs and it's like level one, level two, as opposed to chapters. So it's a pretty fun one.
Does it teach you red light, green light at all? I recently watched a show about game design. No.
That topic is not covered.
I recently got notified that there was an update, a book I read years ago called the C-Sharp Player's Guide. And it again is like teaches you kind of C-Sharp through the act of writing small games. You know, you got like game one is very simple. Maybe at some point you start doing tic-tac-toe. At some point, maybe you do a little dungeon crawler, right? And that's how you kind of are introduced to a lot of the concepts in C-Sharp. And I noticed it just got updated for C-Sharp version 9, which I know 10's almost here. I got notified about that a couple weeks ago. I was like, oh, yeah, I remember that. That follows a similar trend. It's not about game design, but it's kind of, you know, through kind of that joy of gaming, you can potentially learn C-Sharp and maybe grok it a little.
I think the last one on my list, another management book, is called Whale Done. Seen or read that one? Whale is in like from the ocean. It's you know, how to recognize and give recognition and rewards to employees. And some people take issue. I take that back. There's one other one. I lied. There's two more.
Have you made Jake read it?
I haven't. Nope. I probably should. But it actually uses the metaphor of trainers at SeaWorld and how they would reward the whales to perform certain actions and things like that. So if you just give me some raw fish, I should be good. Is the summary there?
We're talking about controversial topics. We're throwing SeaWorld.
Yeah. So you're saying employees are just trapped and, you know,
they can't just keep leave. Throw fruit snacks at them and they'll be okay. Huh?
No, but they definitely talk about, you know, how to properly recognize and how to reward employees. And sometimes it's, you know, sometimes it is just that Starbucks gift card or, you know, whatever, but sometimes it's more than that and how you can, how a good ways to give praise. And it even talks about how just food reward, in their case with whales, turned against them eventually. And, you know, I was like, oh, well, I need more food reward, more food reward, more food reward. And it became an ineffective system. Same idea, right? Oh, I'm going to give you a bonus. And now next time it has to be a bigger bonus. Next time it has to be a bigger bonus, to get that same behavior. And so, you know, how to adapt to that. The other one, I think you have read this one, Who Moved My Cheese?
Oh yeah, no, definitely read that. It's like a pamphlet, right? It's like, yeah, it's 15 pages. Super short. Well. It's really short. That's an excellent one. Because it has everything to do with,
change.
Yeah, accepting change. And that's really hard for a lot of people. And I think there's good ways to present change and bad ways to present change. And that book doesn't necessarily address how to present change, but what to do when you're thrown into a situation where change was thrust upon you, right? And so I think it's a really good, interesting read, right? And of course, about teaching mice to find the cheese when they move it in the maze. And sometimes I think at one point they remove the cheese from the maze entirely and the mouse like goes crazy.
Yeah. It also talks about like, you got to move the cheese because otherwise it gets moldy. You know, that change is inevitable and you have to change.
Yeah.
Big piece of that. And again, we think of that as a developer, right? We're even talking UX UI, you know, you eventually have to accept Reddit has updated their UI.
I will never accept this.
When they get rid of the subdomain old.reddit.com, I will be forced to accept.
Then you just tie into their API and you pull everything that way.
You write your own shell.
So I guess unless someone has a couple of extra books, I would ask the question of, what are you reading currently?
Oh, I do have I'm going to give an honorary mention. So I'm a big book gifter. I gift a ton of books to team members, you know, just general people at work, that kind of stuff. Two that I give away the most, at least the last 2 years, are a book called The Phoenix Project and its follow up, The Unicorn Project. And these are both written as novels, right? So they're kind of stories. But The Phoenix Project is kind of told from the perspective of an IT operations org trying to modernize, trying to understand, the new way of the new model of DevOps and things like that. And then the follow-up, the Unicorn project, is told more from the perspective of a software architect and how software architecture is changing because of the way we now do releases and how frequent these things happen. And those are both great reads for anybody. You don't need to be particularly deep in the technical subject matter to get them, but they definitely will give you a good kind of perspective on where the industry kind of is and how we kind of are trying to do things today versus how we may have done them 10, 15 years ago. So yeah, those are two of the ones I gift the most the last year or two.
Yeah. That opens up kind of a fun topic, and maybe something we should do is I think we should post a question, and the first one to reply to it from the podcast gets a free book.
Ooh.
Mm. So maybe let's think about what that question is, and we'll throw it on next week's episode.
I like it.
All right. For me, within my scope, I'm working on this particularly. I haven't started reading this book, but it's in my to-do list, is The Art of Doing Half the Work, or Doing Twice the Work in Half the Time. It's a Scrum book. By some of the founders of Scrum. So obviously that's within context of working on getting a Scrum course put together. I've been kind of poking around to try and find a good testing book on writing good tests. It's something we've been doing a lot more of lately and something we're going to be getting more towards. And so something I want to be able to kind of help our TAs with, even especially.
There's a book, I think it's I hope I'm not mistaken, The Software Craftsman and Code Complete. But both of those books have sections dedicated to testing, how to do testing, you know, what makes a good test versus a bad test, things of that nature. So that'd be kind of a recommendation there for me. My current book that I'm reading right at this moment is actually titled When You See This Message, It'll Be Too Late. And it's all about cybersecurity breaches that have happened. And it takes the interesting approach of the problem with cybersecurity is not necessarily the technology or lack of technology or the fact that hackers are better than the defenders or anything around that. It's all around legislation and how the laws are failing to actually keep up to date with technology. And that's where the bulk of our problems with cybersecurity are coming from, right? It's all about pointing the finger of blame as opposed to finding a solution. And so I've loved it. I'm about halfway through it at this moment. And, you know, it talks about some of the real famous attacks, TJX and things of that nature. We're talking, you know, credit card companies that were frauded and, you know, kind of how to go about stopping those things. And, you know, again, it talks about the legislation and the lack of legislation that is supporting or protecting companies, individuals, you know, the credit card companies, the banks, and all those different things. So it's a real interesting topic, controversial to say the least, I've really been enjoying it.
I think, and again, not to touch too far into those controversial things, but if you think that there's a possibility that the current legislators understand technology, look no further than the Facebook trial.
Zuckerberg is in front of, it was like two or three senators, something of that.
There's like a dozen or so, but questions like, you know, my bank has the Facebook icon on their page. Have you hacked my credit card?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. That's what that means.
I have to laugh because watching that interview, you see Zuckerberg's face, and I'm not a big fan of the Zuck, right? But, it's painful, you know, and I feel bad for, dare I say, I feel bad for a billionaire, right? Yep. I feel bad for what he had to go through in that questioning.
You can empathize because you have, and I'm sure so many people even listening to this podcast have been in that boat where it's like, oh, you're a developer, right? Yeah, my printer isn't working. Okay.
Oh, that happens to developers too? I thought that was just IT operations. Is like, if it's got a circuit board in it, you will fix it.
Yep, pretty much. Yeah, and that's basically what you're getting is, you know, if those people are octogen, they're super old. Their, you know, average age of, I think, congressman is like 59 to 65 or something like that. And so, yeah, you're explaining.
I think it might even be a little bit older. Yeah,
that doesn't sound as old as I thought you were going to say.
I wouldn't say that the age is necessarily the main issue. There is the concept of they just haven't kept up to date with what technology is, right? So, yeah, but no, it is definitely an issue. And this is funny because they'll throw this kind of back to our UX UI conversation. I was helping just a month or two ago, my 96-year-old grandma, and her computer died, of course. So I got her set up with a new one, and we changed the version, the Linux environment that she was running on. And I can't remember what it was between, but it was like Ubuntu. It was like a two or three number major version upgrade. And when she saw it, she was just like, I don't know how to use my computer anymore. And my heart, you know, just kind of, I was like, oh man, I put in all this work to get you a new computer all set up, and it's faster and it's better. And, you know, she immediately was, well, I don't know how to do anything anymore. So getting it, you know, downgrading it back to the older version, you know, figuring out, trying to put her desktop icons back to where they were.
Just change the GNOME theme or something.
You know, it was, but it was one of those things where
it's called classic now. That's all
for her, you know, at 96 years old, maybe it's not a requirement that she needs to learn, you know, the new technology. Right. And that's, I think, that's a tough question as to, you know, taking Windows 11 and the TPM and, you know, the security concerns. And, you know, she still is using a computer and she does her online banking and all that different stuff. At 96 years old. So on one hand, you say, yeah, you need to be able to adjust with the technology changes and, you know, security concerns and things of that nature. But then at the same time, at that age, you know, it's incredibly difficult. So it's hard to find the right answer there.
So I guess my books, I probably shouldn't list all the ones I'm halfway through, because that's I do a lot of reading.
I have 15 open books right at this moment.
15. Wow, that's nice.
Let's not talk about your browser tab problem either, right?
Hey, there's only 1,000 tabs open in Firefox.
Have you been using Edge's groups? You need to use tab grouping in Edge. It's amazing.
I mean, I've got a lot of tab management strategies going on. I have three Edge windows, each with 300 tabs.
Is a part of that strategy? Close the tab eventually.
No, it's not. We'll talk about that at a future point. So books. Okay. So I'll give you a couple of recent tech books I picked up. I'm rereading a couple of API design books. We got a lot of changes in our API surface coming up at work, a lot of standardization. So I'm just refamiliarizing myself with a lot of that. Picked up a Blazor book recently called Blazor in Action. I'm trying to figure out a little bit more about that. It's an interesting technology for me. I'm playing around with a few side projects. Managerially leadershipy books. I'm rereading The Manager's Path. It's a good little engineering management book. And non-technical books, if you like sci-fi, I just reread a book called Delta V by an author called Daniel Suarez. That's a great little sci-fi kind of near future hard science-y type book. So
near future hard science. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think what we'll do is we'll compile this book list and throw it into our episode repo. And,
yeah, there's definitely a big list here, so we'll have to document it all down.
Yeah, definitely try and drop those. But yeah, no, that's it for me.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for joining us again this week. Hopefully you get some good things to read. And if not, maybe you can send us your make a like or a comment on this podcast, and maybe let us know what your favorite book in the development world is. Until then, we'll see you next week.
That's a wrap for the dev team. If you enjoyed it, please be sure to subscribe to our channel for the latest content anywhere great podcasts are found. And remember, if you want Kencode, wash your hands.